Okay, very good. So the idea of the talk tonight is on the idea of training the heart. And there is a very beautiful passage in the suttas, which I always remember. It's a very simple one, and it's one which doesn't necessarily, it's not necessarily very, might sound very self-evident when you first hear it, but to me it's very beautiful and very powerful. And the passage is in the Potipada Sutta in the Digha Nikaya, and it says, Sikha eka sanya upajanti, sikha eka sanya nirujanti, which means that by means of a training that certain perceptions arise, and by means of a training that certain perceptions cease. And this statement or this idea is absolutely key to Buddhist teachings, Buddhist practice, and it's one thing which I think marks off Buddhism as a religion or as a philosophy from the kind of theistic or salvation orientated religions which are more common in the world, I guess. So in most religions we have this idea that we're going to be saved, right? And I remember the very first interfaith dialogue that I did when I was at Wat Nanachat. I'd only been there for a few weeks, and there was this Christian group who was visiting there, and we had this very nice talk about Buddhism and Christianity and the similarities and differences. And then at the end of it, the lady who was leading the Christian group said, well, you know, at the end I think we're pretty much the same because we both think that somebody's going to come and save us. And we were like, hang on. Right? But it was interesting kind of moment, because, you know, it's obviously completely opposite to what the Buddha taught and to all, everything we've been talking about. But that mindset of thinking, oh, that's what we're going to be doing, it was so ingrained that she couldn't actually hear any other way of doing it. But this is really very, very powerful and very important in Buddhism. There's a lovely sutta in the Sutta Nipata where the Buddha says, I am not able to save you. I'm not able to carry somebody across, but you, by making your own effort, can cross the stream of suffering. Right? So this is a very very powerful teaching, and it's a very empowering teaching. Right? And on the one hand, it's kind of challenging. Right? You can't get to say, oh, I just sort of give up and let somebody come and save me. Right? So it's quite, in that way, it's kind of demanding. We actually have to do something about it. But it's also very empowering. And the Buddha said, another one of my favourite sayings that the Buddha said was that he would not ask us to do it if it were not possible. Right? It is possible to abandon what is unwholesome. If it were not possible, I would not ask you. It is possible to develop what is wholesome. If it were not possible, I would not ask you to do it. And when we think about the Dhamma, we think about what we're practicing here, that is the most empowering thing. It's very easy. Like in Buddhism, it's a very exalted philosophy, right? We think of the Buddha as being like almost superhuman, the things that he could do through his wisdom. And we think of all of the wonderful practitioners, you know, and there's, you know, in Buddhist circles there's so many amazing stories about meditators who can, you know, do all of these psychic powers, or can raise and change their body heat and go into meditation for long periods of time and all of this kind of stuff, and that's all amazing, right? But it can also be distancing, right? It's like, oh, you know, those people are over there. And I'm just over here, right? And I'm still just struggling to deal with greed, hatred and delusion in my own mind, right? Right? So I'm very far from being an advanced practitioner like that. But what you're doing in struggling with greed, hatred and delusion in your own mind, that is the practice. In fact, that is the only practice. Right? That is all there is to Buddhism, is overcoming greed, hatred and delusion. The ending of greed, hatred and delusion is Nibbana. And the way to do that is not by any, there's nothing special about it, there's no trick, there's no secret, okay? It's just recognizing and being mindful. Where is that greed, hatred and delusion? When does it arise? And how do I let go of it? That's all there is to it. So this is something that each person here has already done many times. Right? You've all had greed of one sort or another, countless times. And many times you've gone under the sway of that greed, right? And you've followed it along, right? But also many times you've said, hang on, no, maybe I should share this food instead of eating it all myself. Right? Maybe I should be generous instead of being attached to things. Right? The same thing with hatred. You know, many times we've all had hatred, we've all had anger, and many times we've gone under the sway of that. Right? We've acted, said harsh words, said, done nasty things to try to hurt people. Right? But also many times we haven't done that. Many times we've restrained ourselves, we've recognized what's going on, and we've learned how to let go of that anger. Right? And many times also we've gone under the sway of delusion. Right? We've been confused. We haven't understood what's going on. Right? We've lied to ourselves about what our motivations are, about what we're doing. But also many times we've had wisdom. And many times we've actually recognized what the truth is. And many times we've acted in accordance with the truth and in accordance with wisdom. So those things which are the essence of the Buddhist practice are things which every person here has done on countless occasions. It's not anything exotic, it's nothing unusual, it's nothing strange. You don't need a savior, right? You don't need me to save you. There's no monk, no nun, there's no cosmic Buddha that's going to come and save you. Getting amulets or relics or Buddha images or getting some certificate of enlightenment or getting a blessing or getting a empowerment or all of those things are all completely irrelevant. The only thing that matters is whether you can abandon greed, hatred and delusion or not. And so this is that training that the Buddha taught. And what the Buddha means by training, essentially, is just doing things again and again. Basically, that's all. Right? So by means of a training, certain perceptions arise. By means of training, certain perceptions cease. Right? So the more we act out of greed, then the more we're amplifying that tendency. The more we act out of hatred, the more we're amplifying that tendency. The more we act out of delusion, the more we're amplifying that tendency. And again, with the opposites, the more we act out of letting go, the more we act out of loving kindness, the more we act out of wisdom, then the more we are amplifying those tendencies. That's all that the training means. Right? So this is how we practice Dhamma. Now, the Noble Eightfold Path, the Buddha taught, is a kind of a more detailed explanation of that same thing. So the Eightfold Path and all the different teachings on meditations and different kinds of things that the Buddha taught, these are all giving us different perspectives, different approaches, different frameworks that's going to be helpful for identifying and practicing those things in the same in different ways or a different context. But basically, it's all the same thing, right? It's all about recognizing greed, hatred, and delusion and being able to let go of it. Okay, so when it comes to meditation, this is what is the key to understanding meditation. It's not about finding the right meditation method or finding the ideal place to meditate or finding the right time of day to meditate or the right kind of meditation cushion or anything like that. Okay, meditation, the success in meditation is your ability to be able to let go of greed, hatred and delusion. And so what we do when we meditate is we do that on a more subtle level. Okay? Now, outside of meditation we do the same thing, but we do it at a more coarse level. So when you're driving on your way here, maybe you get stuck in a traffic jam and you want to yell at the guy in the car next to you and you restrain yourself from yelling at them. Okay? So this is letting go of a little bit of hatred, okay? And maybe, if you're really clever, you might even say, thank you, O great Bodhisattva, for teaching me the virtue of patience, okay? So you can convert that anger into gratitude and appreciation. But that's still happening on a relatively shallow level, a relatively coarse level. And when you come along to meditate, you sit down, you close your eyes, you look inside your own heart, you're looking at the same things much more closely. The same forces are there, but you see them like at a microscopic level. You see them in such subtle forms, forms that normally we just wouldn't notice. And yet, even though there are things that are so tiny, they're also incredibly powerful. I don't know if you've ever had the experience when you're meditating, and sometimes you're meditating and you get a bit tired, and there's like this kind of, this little, how do I put it, like this little kind of movement in your mind, little kind of nudge, that kind of says, oh, maybe you should lie down and have a bit of a sleep instead of meditating, right? And it's this tiny, tiny little thing, right? It's not like an overwhelming force or anything like that. It's just like this tiny little suggestion in the back of your mind. And the next thing you know, there you are lying down having a sleep. That's where your wisdom's arising. This is where you see, the roots of these things, right? That's where they come from, right? These tiny little things. And you can see, the same way anger arises, right? You see it. Right? And when you're sitting in meditation, when you first begin, maybe your mind is sort of still swept up with thoughts and different emotions and things like that. And it takes a while for those things to settle down. Gradually, as they settle down, they gradually become more and more subtle. There's more space around them. When you have more space around things, you see them much more clearly. And you see that actually greed, hatred, and delusion are just tiny, tiny little things. They're tiny little things. They're just very tenacious, that's all. They keep coming back. Actually, any moment or any thought of greed, hatred, and delusion is easy enough to let go of. Right? It's not that difficult, right? You recognize it. Oh, okay, that's what it is. You let go of it. End of story. Right? But they keep coming back again and again and again. So this is why we need that persistence. Right? You need that training. Right? You keep on doing it again and again and again. So this way of practicing, of conditioning your mind, is that you're conditioning your mind away from those things that create suffering and towards those things that create happiness. Right. And this is the root of the Buddhist conception of what we consider to be the good, right? Or what goodness is. So once again, from a Buddhist point of view, we don't see goodness as being something which is supplied on a bunch of tablets that's handed down from heaven. Goodness is not something which is ingrained in the universe, right? There's no fundamental quality in the universe which is goodness or badness, right? But what's good and what's bad is what leads to happiness or what leads to suffering. So when we do those things which are on the side of letting go, on the side of loving kindness, on the side of wisdom, they'll lead to happiness. When we do those other things, they lead to suffering. That's all. So when we look at it in that way, then we see that good and bad are not things that we should be judgmental about. In Buddhist texts and translations, we have this word called papa, which is often translated as evil. And I had a friend of mine a number of years ago, a monk, and he began a new monastery, and the name of the monastery road was Paparatta Road, and because he didn't know Pali, so he asked me, oh, what does Paparatta, it sounds like a Pali word, what does it mean in Pali? I said, Venerable, you're not going to like this, but it means lover of evil. Oh well, there you go, sometimes these things work out, sometimes not so much. So you have this word papa, which sometimes we translate as evil, but it doesn't really mean evil. Like evil has something which is, it has this kind of core kind of malice, it's something which is like just inherently wrong, right? It's a distortion of reality. It's something, there's this huge kind of judgment And something, there's something implacable and unchangeable about the idea of evil. It just is, like this force in the world. But papa doesn't mean anything even vaguely like that, right? So papa just means those things that tend to lead to suffering. That's all, right? So there's no kind of judgmental, there's nothing judgmental about it. There's nothing, in a sense, you could say there's nothing right and wrong about it, right? And you could even say we could do away with the concepts of right and wrong in Buddhism, right? You say, well, what are those things that lead to suffering? What are those things that lead to happiness? That's all. And that's what we call good. We call good is those things that lead to happiness. And we use the word bad to call those things that lead to suffering. And that's all. So if you want to do those things, fine. Whatever. I'm not here. Often people say to me, oh, can I do this or can I do that? Who appointed me as the teller of what to do, right? I'm not here to tell you what to do. You'd make your own choice, right? But just understand that if you make choices based on greed, hatred and delusion, that will lead to suffering, right? That's all. You can still do it if you want. Please, go ahead, right? Okay, I mean, so in Buddhism, we'd only want to restrict that, really, if you're going to cause suffering for others, right? So if you're going to do something which is going to harm others or injure them, then of course, then that needs to be checked. But in terms of what you do with your own life, it's your choice. So it's not up to us to enforce that or to be telling you what you should do or what you shouldn't do. But just to point out, you know, this is what leads to suffering, this is what leads to happiness. And most of those things you know already. Right? I mean, most people actually they actually know that making lots of money isn't going to lead to happiness. Right? I mean, it's pretty obvious, really. Right? Most people know that living a life which is full of love is going to lead to more happiness than living a life where you're going around being angry and hating everybody. It's not rocket science. So what we need is that support and that encouragement to be able to recognize that and to keep on doing it. And especially, I think, especially the important thing is to have the empowerment to know that you can do it. And so this is something which you find is very, very characteristic in the Buddha's teachings. When people would ask him, you know, can I do this or should I do that, then he would never say, you should do this, you should do that. He would say, well, if you do this, this is the result. I was talking with, we did some sutta classes a few weeks ago with some people from Singapore. And we were talking about this, and I talked about the difference between in the blessing chants in Buddhism. And we were talking about the difference between earlier and later texts in Buddhism. And there's a very, very interesting difference in the blessing chants. Like if you listen to what the monks chant, then usually at mealtime and other occasions, the monks or the nuns will do some chants for blessing. You know, and one of the most famous ones, Bhavatu Sabba Mangalam Rakkhantu Sabba Devata, and so on. And I pointed out that there's a very interesting difference which you can tell in those blessing chants to be able to know which one is early and which one is late, which one was taught by the Buddha and which one was late at that time. It's very easy to tell, and the difference is tu and pi. Right? If you hear a tu in the chanting, then it must be a later one. If you hear a ti, then it's an earlier one. Right? So if you hear something like bhavatu sabbamangalam rakkhantu Sabba Devata, then this is a later chant, right? What does it mean? May you have all blessings. May all the devas protect you, right? So it has this thing of may this happen, may that happen. And that's what the tu ending in Pali means, right? It means may this be so. And the Buddha never used that kind of language when he was doing that kind of thing. He would always use the ti. And so, for example, we have Abhivadana Sili Sanichang Buddha Pachayino Chataro Dhamma Vardhan. Ti, ayuvano sukhang balang. So there's no tu in there, there's only the ti. And the ti is a present active verb form. It doesn't say what should be, it says what is. If somebody lives a life of respecting and honoring those worthy of respect and always looking after them, then they may expect for benefits, long life, happiness, beauty, and ayuvana sukhang balang, and good health. So this is the cause, and that is the effect. Right? It's not saying may you have these things, it's pointing out cause and effect, right? If you live a good life and you help others, then that's good karma, and because of that good karma, then you'll tend to have a good life as well. This is cause and effect. So all of the Buddha's verses like that, and the Modena verses, always have deep form, cause and effect. Not the do form, it's not trying to make something happen. So again, this idea that the Buddha's not there to as a saviour, he's there as a teacher, as a guide. So when we, for me, this kind of reflection is very powerful. And for me, it's also very inviting. Right? The Buddha was giving these teachings, he's inviting us to look at it. This characteristic of the Dhamma is called ehibasiko. Right? Inviting inspection. Come and see. So you try it out and you see. You train your heart and you see. You try meditating and you see. Right? You see what it's like if you have greed in your mind. You see what it's like if you don't have greed in your mind. What is it like? You look at it, you investigate, you understand. Right? And it's only your understanding that's going to help you. Okay? Nobody else's. Somebody once came to Ajahn Chah, the teacher of my lineage. Someone came to his monastery once and they asked him, it's a very famous story. I asked him, do you teach your disciples by reading their minds? Right? So does he sit up there and read everybody's minds? Okay, you need to be doing this kind of meditation, right? So this is what a lot of people want, right? So they want to go and find some great teacher and read their mind and tell them, oh, you do this, and then you get like, oh, you need to do this kind of meditation. This is what you did in your past life, so if you do that, you'll go really fast in your meditation. Right? And Ajahn Chah's response, he says, here at my monastery, we learn how to read our own minds. We learn how to read our own mind. It's not Ajahn Chah's job to tell you what to think, right? It's not my job to tell you how to meditate, okay? You figure that out for yourself. Okay? We give some guidance, we give the help that we have, but you have to understand it for yourself. So this is what that idea of training the heart is all about. When we take up spiritual practice, then I think it's quite natural that we want to find, it seems that there's a strong need or strong tendency for us to fixate or to project and to create some kind of guru worship. People think, oh, so-and-so is so wonderful, so-and-so is so great. And that's okay, right? That can help us. But it can also be a great hindrance. If you are not able to be independent of your teacher, if you're not able to have a different opinion from your teacher, there's something that's very wrong. And that's something which I really like living at the moment. I'm living in Bodhnyana Monastery, and one of the things I really like about being there is that you can disagree with Ajahn Brahm, and it's okay, right? It's all right. In fact, I sit in between Ajahn Brahm and Ajahn Brahmali, and Ajahn Brahmali has been there for many years now. He's been there for about 20 years. And sometimes it's like listening to a bickering married couple, right? Oh, we're going to put the heart on that side. You can't put it on that side because of blah, 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 and then back and forth and so on. And it's very nice because Ajahn Brahmali is not, they have incredible love and respect for each other, but they're quite happy to disagree, right? And it's quite okay. Right? And that's a mature relationship, right? If you're in a spiritual context where you can't have a different opinion, where there's something wrong with you if you have a different opinion, right? Then there's something very unhealthy about that. You should have different opinions, right? And you should be able to express those different opinions. Right? So if there's anything that I've said this evening that you don't like, good. You don't agree with me? Good. Please go away and say, oh, Pandita said this, but I think he's wrong because of this and this. Right? Good. Right? It's not, you don't have to be ashamed of that. That's what I want. We did a Karma and Rebirth course here a few weeks ago, and one of the stories that someone told, one of the stories of a child who was apparently able to recollect her past life. But one of the students thought there were a couple of details in the story that didn't ring quite true. So she went afterwards, and she's got a background in history studies, and she went and looked, and this was a girl who was born in England in a particular village in the late 19th century. And she went and she looked up the historical records, birth and death records, birth certificates, death certificates, and she figured out, no, there wasn't anybody of that name born at that time. And went, and she actually went and investigated it. I was like, oh my God, I've been teaching Dhamma for like nearly 20 years now, and I think that's almost the first time that anyone's actually gone and investigated something. It's probably not true, but it's a fairly rare occurrence. Right? And she went away and she actually tested it and said, oh no, it doesn't actually fit the facts. That doesn't mean the story's wrong, it just means that it's not as clear cut as we thought it was, right? So that's really what, you know, what we're trying to see in students, in practitioners. We don't want people to just sort of go, you know, mindlessly kind of mouthing, this is what so and so says, this is what so and so says. Fine, you learn from what I say, learn from what other teachers say, and so on. Discuss it among yourself, and you can't make up your own mind. Right? I don't imagine that my truth is going to be the same for all of you. In fact, that is completely absurd. You know, one of the things that I really notice when I'm teaching retreats, right? You teach a retreat and it's very weird, right? You do like, I'll give like one Dhamma talk, right? So there's one set of words coming out of here. A set of words which I think have a fairly clear meaning, okay? I think what I'm saying makes sense and is not too difficult to understand. And yet if there's 30 people on the retreat, there's like 30 different sets of words going to the ears. And they all come away with completely different things, and they meditate in completely different ways. If you give one set of meditation instructions, I mean, not completely different ways, right? But everyone has their own take on it, and they'll come and they'll all tell you, and all of their experiences are so different, right? And after a while, you realize that this idea that somehow you can have like one meditation method and everyone's doing the same meditation method is just nonsense, right? It never happens, right? Everybody is practicing in their own way. Everyone's finding their own path. Maybe as the meditation gets deeper, as you get closer to deep states of samadhi or something, it might sort of converge, it becomes more similar. But certainly when we start out, we're starting out from such different places. So this is our journey, is to try to discover this and to just try to do a little bit better next time, that's all. Not to try to get it perfect, but to try to get it a little bit better. Okay, very good. So it's over to you guys now. If you've got some questions or would like to discuss something or bring up any points, then that would be good. One of the things that's very nice about the Buddhist tradition is that the Buddhist tradition is actually full of Q&As. There's actually a whole class of Buddhist literature called the Vyakarana, which basically just means Q&As. And if you look in the suttas, it's almost all of the longer discourses is actually people coming up and asking the Buddha questions and disagreeing with him and arguing with him. And so if it wasn't for people asking questions, our suttas would have been a lot smaller, which means I'd probably be out of a job. But anyway, so questions?
I was just wondering, I was reading in my eyes and which he said that she was talking about training the heart and saying that when the heart is trained, you learn to love all things unconditionally, not because they deserve it, but because you can't help it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that would be really interesting
Right. And I'm just wondering whether you could extend that unto you. Yeah, that's a nice idea, isn't it? Yeah? I mean, that's what unconditional means, isn't it? Right? So normally we're kind of stingy with our love. As if we love somebody who's not worthy, then somehow it'll harm us or something. Yeah. But again, that's the love that a mother has for a child, isn't it? It's like in the Metta Sutta. So you're not thinking, you know, who's worthy or not. Like if my parents loved, you know, my sister and I according to who was worthy. Well, my sister was always more hardworking than I. She was always more diligent. And I was always the bad one who'd be messing around and stuff. So if they were going to decide who to love according to worthiness, then I would have got a lot less love than my sister. But that wasn't the case, fortunately. And you don't even think about that, yeah? So yeah, that's a really nice way of putting it. Sure.
What's causing that?
And that's where the concept of the hindrances, right, is relevant, because the idea of the hindrances, right, the five hindrances are what hinder, they block, they obstruct, right? And so when the hindrances are not there, or when they're very quiet, then the mind isn't obstructed. So this again, it's just part of how the nature of the mind works. Yeah, the mind's always conditioned. So if the hindrances are there, that's what they're blocking. They're blocking you from loving as much as you could. They're blocking you from being as compassionate as you might be. They're blocking you from being as wise as you might be. So they're always there, and they're always undermining these things. So when you meditate and you get rid of those hindrances, that's just what happens. Everything's unblocked.
I don't like the idea
of the kind of they're like the mind having a kind of an underlying ontological nature. It's not like there's this thing which is there which is being blocked, right? It's just about conditions. Like if the conditions are there for it to have that, then they will have it. If not, then it won't.
I have a question, and that's a lot more human-related, but it is related to about trying to open up our hearts and be compassionate. How do you try to do that when you have people in your life that maybe you really don't like, or you know, that really challenge you to perhaps be compassionate? You know, is it about just trying to be compassionate and then doing it, but almost forcing yourself to do it, you know, because sometimes, you know, the whole practice is to calm our hearts and to just be still and just be easy and take life. Easier. But sometimes being compassionate to another person, it might be as more of a personality change. You're like, why? This person is so annoying. You know, and is it about, like, really just opening your heart to try to be compassionate, and is it about maybe targeting specific people in your life that you find the most challenging to really test yourself about opening your heart to go, this is what it's going to take, and you should really, you know, try and achieve those objectives or all those blockages.
Have you tried doing that?
It's not giving me more stillness, it's giving me stress more than anything else.
Okay.
It's hard to be compassionate to people with certain.
See, that's why monks like to go away into the forest and stuff, because it's much easier to have loving kindness for all sentient beings when you don't have to actually talk to them.
Yeah, I know.
So in some ways, okay. I mean, just to talk on a practical level, you have to do what you can, right? And you have to sort of focus your energies. Yeah. And in a way, you have to choose your battles. Okay, so on the one hand, you have this idea that you have to, you know, of course, being able to love everyone is great, but then, you know, where do we start, right? And so if you can have that feeling of love or kindness towards one more person than you do right now, then that's a good thing. Yeah? The fact that you haven't had that loving kindness for everybody yet, okay, that just means that you're not completely enlightened. Okay, so deal with it, right? Yeah, it's okay. That's just reality. But if we can make it a little bit bigger, then we're doing pretty well. Yeah? So instead of thinking, oh, I've got to sort of overcome this dislike of these really hated people and so on, you just say, well, what can I do? Rather than struggling with something that you find is hard, why don't you just say, well, what can I do that's easy? Yeah? Maybe I can love another puppy today. Right? I can achieve, that's already good. That's good, that's nice. I'll find somebody who's easy to love, right? And you kind of do that. And by doing that, this is something which is basic kind of learning strategy as well, is something that, you know, I learned playing music and things, is you don't learn by making mistakes, right? You learn by doing things right. So again, if you're trying to train, again, my experience, to speak from what I know, but experience of practicing the guitar, is you do something which is doable, and you keep on doing it again and again and again, and you don't sit there thinking, oh, you know, I can't play as good as Jimi Hendrix, right? You think, how can I play this thing a little bit better? Yeah? And you keep on doing that thing a little bit better and a little bit better and a little bit better. Yeah? And so then. Then when you get really kind of annoyed and pissed off with people and you're like, what do you do, right? Well, in some cases, there's an interesting sutta, one of the most important suttas in the Pali Canon actually, is called the Sabhasava Sutta, all the defilements, Majjhima Nikaya number 2. But one of the reasons that that's interesting is because it gives you a whole bunch of different strategies for dealing with different kinds of defilements, okay? Some of them are defilements to be overcome by avoiding, okay? So in some cases, avoiding is okay, right? Some cases, it's defilements to be overcome by using, okay? So there might be some things which you might have defilements about. For example, you might be really attached to your clothes, right? Maybe you really like fashion, you like going shopping and having the latest clothes and things like that. Well, you can't overcome those defilements by not having clothes, right? You're still going to have to wear clothes, and so you have to do that and develop a healthier and more balanced relationship with your clothes while you're wearing them. You appreciate, well, these clothes are actually not here so that I can make myself look beautiful or something, but they're here so that I can, you know, keep warm, and they have a practical purpose, right? So you learn to understand what's the purpose of these things better. So the way that we respond to different kinds of challenges, there's not just one way of doing it. There are many different ways. It depends on the context, and it depends how these things play out for ourselves. So in that kind of context, you think about that. Well, if there's somebody who's really annoying in your life, it depends, doesn't it, right? Sometimes you can just avoid them, okay? Sometimes maybe if you're at work or something like that, you can sort of step the other way and you don't have to see them, right? And that's okay, right? It's not ideal, it's not perfect, but it's better than getting in an argument. Better than spending the whole day running around in your head and thinking how much you hate that person, right? On the other hand, sometimes you can't do that, right? Sometimes maybe you're married to them, right? Bit of a hassle, right? I did this one retreat, this loving kindness retreat, a number of years ago, where you know, where I teach loving kindness, you have like four stages, right? So yourself, a loved person, a neutral person, and then a disliked person, okay? And so then we're doing kind of the interviews, and people would be talking to people, and they'd tell me who their disliked person is. And by the end of it, I was saying, okay, you have the four people, is the loved one, the neutral one, the oneself, the loved one, the neutral person, and the husband. Because so many people came up to me and said that the person they're doing for their disliked one was their husband, right? And so I kind of made this joke about it, okay? It was kind of a joke, but kind of wasn't also, right? And one lady came on the retreat and she was like, oh my God, she said, this is just so amazing. This is like the first time in as long as I can remember that I haven't hated my husband on this retreat, yeah? And this other lady came up to me. It was quite interesting. She came up to me afterwards and she said, you know, I appreciate the, you know, the joke and you're putting a bit of humour in there and that's all very nice, but I just want to let you know, I really love my husband. You know, we really respect each other. He really supports me on my spiritual practice and we have a really good relationship. And I said, oh, well, that's really nice to hear. 3 or 4 years later, they got divorced. So there you go. So this is reinforcing my own choice to become a monk. Complete cynicism about these things. But anyway, moving along. Okay, so the point being that in some cases you can't avoid it. So then you're going to have to figure out some way of dealing with it, right? And that's obviously a very difficult situation. So there's not one answer. You do what you can. If you can hate that person a little bit less, right? That's good, right? Right. So again, not kind of judging it, not saying hate. There's nothing wrong with hate, right? Don't be thinking that I shouldn't hate. Hate is bad. That's right. Hate's all right. Hate as much as you like. You just know that it will lead to suffering. Yeah? So if you don't want to suffer, see if you can lessen that hate. And if you lessen the hate a little bit, then maybe you can suffer a little bit less. Right? And you can lessen the hate a little bit very simply. Right? Rather than thinking, how do I let go of this? How do I love that person unconditionally? Then maybe you think, can I think of one good quality that that person has? Right? And at that time when you're thinking of one good quality that the person has, you're not actually hating them. Yeah? You'll maybe hate them a little bit less. We had this interesting thing at a monastery I was at Bodhnyana many years ago. This was when I was first there in the late 90s. There's one fellow who used to come and stay there who was unbelievable. Okay, I mean, he had mental problems, right? So we all, you know, we understand that. But God, he was so annoying. He was incredibly loud, right? Just loud and obnoxious and coarse and all of this kind of stuff all of the time. And all of the monks sort of couldn't stand him, you know. And anyway, so he'd come and say, and he'd been kicked out of just about every monastery and Buddhist center in Australia, right? One after the other, because people just couldn't stand him. Anyway, after being in the monastery and causing all of his problems and all of this hassle and so on, he went back home, and then he wrote back a letter to Ajahn Brahm saying, could you please write me a reference for my job application? Right? So all of the monks were kind of laughing about this. Ajahn Brahm sat down and wrote a beautiful reference, which was just lovely and actually all true, right? He actually said all these really nice things about this fellow, which were actually all true. And we had to admit, actually, he does have a lot of really good qualities. He actually is very intelligent, right? He actually is very passionate about what he does, right? And so on and so on, all the things that he'd said. Right? So this is where, if you think of some good qualities, then maybe you're not, you know, maybe it's still, you're not, have that complete, perfect loving kindness, but maybe you can deal with the anger a little bit better. Well, if you want some tips and some guidelines to help doing that, that's one of the best passages in the Visuddhimagga, which you probably have here somewhere, The Path of Purification. It's got a fantastic chapter on loving kindness meditation, and it's got all of these methods for overcoming anger. In fact, it's got so many methods for overcoming anger that by the time you finish reading through them all, you will have forgotten about what you were angry about in the beginning.
Thank you. Yeah, I was always curious about some of the teachings around, you know, showing compassion and even compassion to enemies and so forth, to really get to that point, to perhaps, you know, turning hate to love and kindness. And so forth. So I was curious about what that pathway was done.
In addition to your question, how does one use their discernment as a guideline in conjunction to what Buddha, you know, taught in regards to having admirable friends and knowing when to kind of give or take based on certain qualities? And
you mean how to get rid of bad friends?
Well, like you said, if you know, there's anger, then you don't want to feel anger because you're the one feeling anger, so you want to let go of it as quickly as possible. But, you know, if you've got lifelong friends that you know that, for instance, lie all the time and don't display certain qualities that you're trying to wean away from, how does one exercise the right discernment in regards to, you know, do you maintain friendship, how much loving kindness do you give, where do you kind of, you know, at what skill or what tools or what skillfulness do you apply to make sure that, you know, you're still acting in the right way and being compassionate, but at the same time not being with those friends.
Yeah, it's the easy way, becoming a monk. Yeah, it's interesting. And when you said that, it reminded me of a friend that I had at uni, when I went to uni. And maybe this doesn't answer your question, but this is just an interesting story that it was something that I only kind of realized much later, right? But it turned out that she was a pathological liar. But we were doing the same course when I first went there, did the first year uni. And I always remember that the first essay that we did, we had to write an essay on Moby Dick. And I really loved that book, right? I really, really loved it. And I wrote what I thought was a really good essay. And she hadn't even read the book, right? She just read the Brodie's notes on the book, right? And wrote this essay. And she got a better mark than I did, right? And immediately I saw that, I thought, well, these people, they can't even tell whether you've read the book or not, or whether you're just copying the notes. So I was immediately disillusioned by the markers and the lecturers there. And that was, I guess, one of the things that sort of part of my gradual but inevitable course towards leaving the uni. But interestingly enough, it turned out that at least, I'm not sure about the first year that she was there, but at least for the second year, she wasn't actually enrolled. Right, everything that she, in her life was a lie. Right, we were her closest friends. Right, we would hang around all the time, and she would come there and hang around with us and go to lectures and all of these things. And she wasn't actually even enrolled. It was all just a lie. Yeah, yeah. And I only learned about this much later. We never found out at the time. Yeah. So yeah. I was funny because even though that actually, you know, looking back on it, it actually did influence me quite a bit. You know, only subtly at the time, but it did influence me. But I never felt any anger or resentment or something. I mean, it's so, in a sense, it's so crazy that you have to feel kind of a bit sorry for her. But she ended up doing okay. She apparently went to got a job in the public service. She lied about her university degree, which she got for a course that she never enrolled in, and got a reasonable job and is doing quite well in the public service. Last time I heard. So there you go.
So from your understanding of the Buddha, what would he do in regards to someone who had
always
lied to him during his mistakes? What do
you think
he would have done?
Yeah. Well, I mean, he would always first thing he would always do would be to ask them, is this true? Right? And to me, that's one of the most powerful things, powerful principles. And you find that it's used all the way through the Vinaya, right? The first thing that the Buddha says is, if he hears something, somebody's done something wrong, or he suspects something, whatever, the first thing is, please come, bring them to me, and he asks them, is this true? And I'm constantly astonished. You know, you look at the way that people handle conflicts and all of these kinds of things, that's the last thing that people do, right? It's always the last thing, is to actually ask whether it's true or not. Everyone spreads the rumours and backstabbing and all of this stuff all round and round and round and round in circles, and nobody ever thinks to actually ask a person, is that true? You know, it's the same thing has happened to me. Again, just to give another story of what happened with Ajahn Brahm, when this whole thing of the bhikkhuni ordination came up and people were spreading these, I don't need to go into the details, but there was this particular rumour that was going around about this naughty thing that I'd done. Apparently had published something on the web which was misrepresented, what somebody said or something like that, and everyone was saying, oh, this is so terrible. And Ajahn Brahm asked me, did you do this? And he was the only one who actually asked me. And I said, no, I didn't do it. Yeah. But then that doesn't stop the kind of all the rumours and things that's going around. So the first thing to do is ask. And on many occasions, that's actually all you need to do. I mean, sometimes it's not. Sometimes people will lie, and we've had cases like that. And so sometimes, but you just need to, you know, handle people gently, even if they're lying to you. Right? If somebody's lying, then they have a reason for it. Right? there's something mixed up in their heads, right? There's some kind of fear that they have. There's some kind of loss that they have, right? Maybe they think that you're not going to like them. Maybe they think they're going to be abandoned, or they're going to be kicked out, or you won't talk to them, or you'll be angry or something. And so they have that fear. So rather than, you know, getting angry with them or whatever, then you have compassion for the fear that they have. And you make sure that they feel safe. And you don't in most cases, you know, I mean, obviously there are cases when you have to, but in most cases you don't press it too hard. Because you even if you find the truth about that particular thing, then it's not going to help you in the future. You know, the main thing you want to do in the future is just to keep that connection. And so somebody has to feel that there's a relationship of trust there. So yes, yeah, it's a bit difficult to say anything more specific without going into, you know, specifics. But just generally, just try to trust people a little bit more, yeah. and just ask them what happened, and you'll be surprised at how often people will tell you the truth. Yeah. We had another case. I remember when I was at Santi many years ago, we had one young girl came and stayed with us. She would have been 18 or something like that, and she's like an angel. My God, this girl is like, she's like wafting around the place, like her feet are like 2 feet above the ground, you know, and she's so pure hearted and so sweet and so delicate, right? It's just such a lovely person in every way, right? Turns out that she was very kind of badly bulimic, was stealing food from the kitchen and binging and vomiting it out and all of these kinds of things. And when she got found out, she was, you know, somebody asked her about it, and she just flatly lied for days, you know, until eventually she just broke down and started crying, and all the tears came out and all of these things. That's just, you would never guess, you know. She's the most pure person you could possibly imagine. Yeah. And she's lying to everyone. So Jesse and Kari, you've just come back from practicing in Thailand. So you must have some questions from your practice time there.
Okay. All right. Yeah, actually, when we first arrived, my meditation was okay. And I went and took a 2-week holiday with my sister to the islands and came back for 1 week. And the whole time I was just filled with anxiety that came from nowhere in particular. So I took a look at my precepts and I thought, yeah, I'm trying to keep them. I couldn't find the root of this anxiety. Would you offer any light on that?
Well, what happened at the end? How long did that last for?
Well, you know, it actually went away when we found out we were coming from Bodhiana and coming here, and then there was like super intense anxiety for 2 days.
Uh-huh.
And now we're here and it's gone, actually. So I guess I answered my own question.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's these things that happen when you know, anxiety, whatever, depression, sadness and things. And you see, when you see those things happening because of some clear enough cause, right, then it's not really a problem. But it's, you know, it's just natural, and you can see it, you can see the cause, you can understand it. But it's when you see these things happening, you've got no idea where is this coming from, right? That's when it becomes much harder to deal with and harder to cope with, because you never, then it becomes fearful. You never know when it's going to come back and you're out of control. Yeah. But in that case, it seems pretty obvious. You're not sure about where you're going to go, what you're going to be. Yeah?
Yeah, very much.
Yeah.
Still not.
But that's, you know, that's not a bad thing to do, you know, to it's not a bad thing actually in Dharma practice to have that kind of anxiety. You know, because it's essentially what it is, it's kind of exposing the kind of the myth of security that we have, right?
Mm.
And we think that everything is safe.
You know,
there's a classic dialogue between the Buddha and this farmer at the beginning of the Suttanipata, and the farmer saying, you know, I'm really secure, I've got my lands and my house and my cattle and my family and everything. And so that's why I'm safe and secure. And the Buddha's saying, I don't have any lands, I don't have any cattle, I don't have any wealth, I don't have any family, and that's why I'm safe and secure.
Mm.
Yeah?
Well, that's the exact conversation I've had with my dad the last 4 days.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, there's been many discussions, and he's like, what about your future? What about your security? And he's 50 and in between contract jobs. I'm like, Dad, what about your future? What about your security? And he's like, you're giving up everything for a mirage. I'm like, you're the one in the mirage.
That's exactly right. Yeah. You should read that discussion in the... You know, do you know the one I'm talking about?
In Sutta?
Sutta Nipata.
No, I don't know it.
I'll get it for you later, but yeah, the first chapter is exactly that. Yeah, you can send it to your dad and say.
I got
well,
the lecture
here
this morning.
We've got him into meditation now, so we've planted the seeds. It's only a matter of time before this.
The best strategy, you know, because this happens to me quite a lot, and especially with young people, especially young people from like Asian backgrounds, because their parents have a lot of expectations on them, and they say, oh, I want to be a monk or I want to be a nun, but my mother would kill herself if I became if I ordained. That's what people say. And so I say, okay, what's the solution? Easy, grow your hair, drop out of uni, join a rock and roll band, and your parents will be delighted if you do anything else. I'm going to become a monk. Oh, fantastic! That's such a great idea.
Younger sisters, and I said, well, look, Mum, in 10 years' time, you'll be so busy hearing about my sister's problems, you won't have to meddle in my happiness.
That's right, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's good. That's good if you can, you know, profit on your expectations of the future suffering of your sisters.
I can profit on the current suffering from my sister.
All right. Yeah.
In terms, well, one part is on some days, like I'm very excited. You know, there's this, I guess you would say, rapture or excitement that just builds, and I guess oftentimes it can come from both the practice, but also from reading or something like an inspiring sutta or something like that. And then it's really easy to get up at, you know, you want to get up at 4 a.m. or whatever it is and sit and meditate, and you know, there's never enough time in the day to do it. And there's other days, obviously, where, you know, getting up is very difficult. And I know that, you know, there's this up and down, but I guess in terms of, you know, working with that discernment and that management to find that inspiration through things, because I can also get too caught up in reading, where it's just sort of becomes an intellectual thing or whatever it might be. And, yeah, I mean, I guess in this question there is some of that desire to build and maintain that energy. I mean, I see that it's, even though you can't control it, so to speak, it's something you can create the causes and conditions for, so that it, you know, like a little plant you're trying to grow up or something.
Yeah. Well, the Dhamma practice, you know, is kind of like marriage, right? You know, you have true love and honeymoon and all of that kind of stuff, and it's all very exciting and wonderful and everything. And then a few years down the track, it gets very mundane. And it's just like, oh yeah, it's another meditation retreat, yeah, whatever. You know, and that's how the human mind is, right? It's not, you can't escape from it. That's how it is. So there's a very nice passage in the ordination procedure for Chinese monastics that's actually missing from the Pali procedure, but it says in the Chinese ordination procedure, it says something like, may you not lose the inspiration that brought you to seek ordination in the first place. And that was, I think, a really nice and a really interesting thing that was there, and I think that's come out of a lot of wisdom that people find. That's what happens, you know, you join spiritual practice and it can be very exciting, it's really wonderful, so many amazing things. And then after a while, well, you've heard most of the amazing things, right? And you've done, you've seen all those teachers, people were saying they're so great, you've seen them, and yeah, they're pretty good. And you did that meditation, and gradually the newness of it and the excitement of it wears off. But of course, that's where, you know, your real spiritual practice starts, right? It's not when things, everything's going your way and everything's new and exciting, but it's when you're starting to really integrate it and really settle into it for the long term and really see how is this going to work and how is it going to evolve. And if you don't have some kind of positive emotional connection, right, it's just not going to work, right? That's how life goes, right? So you have to have something that gives you some excitement, something that gives you some some love, some interest, some passion in what you're doing in your Dhamma practice. And rarely, if ever, is meditation alone going to do that, right? Meditation, of course, is an important part of that, right? But meditation has its ups and downs, and sometimes you can meditate a lot and sometimes you can't, and all of that stuff. So you're going to have to find something else. Of course, that's why the Eightfold Path has eight factors, right? It's not just about meditation. So in your livelihood, and in what we talked about today, about the good friendship and these kinds of things, and these are also things that's important to cultivate for the long term. You know, it's something I see a lot of times is with people, especially younger people who come to a practice are very, very enthusiastic, and they come along and they want to give up everything and they just want to come and they do these very intensive retreats. And yeah, you do that for a few months and it's great. But then what happens? Right?
Yeah, that's what we see in our travels. I mean, we've been over the course of a year, and we both see the people who fail off to the side of it,
okay,
what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like this last month has been the first period where I start to see, well, you know, of course I want to come and get teaching from you,
yeah,
or Ajahn Brahm or whoever, but I see, well, okay, I read his book and I generally understand his instructions,
yeah,
and he could tell them to me and give me that specific advice or whatever, and I'm still going to have to go and sit,
yeah,
and meditate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And having whoever around isn't going to be the one. He can't meditate for me. He can't make my hour go faster or better or anything like that.
Yeah.
I'm the only one who can sit through all of this.
Yeah.
And I just see, as a Westerner, and maybe Buddhism in general for anyone, that there's the opportunity, you know, to really dedicate your life to it. You know, it really takes a lot from you personally. There's not a set of, it's not easy to walk into a place that's going to make it easy for you, just in
sure,
the way you're talking about it,
sure,
that, you know, my biggest fear, worry, concern about it is creating the sustainable practice and not just getting caught up in the emotion of the moment towards,
yeah,
it,
yeah,
and finding a way to build something,
sure,
that's actually going to last rather than,
yeah,
burn out in a year or a week or a month. Or,
yeah, 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 yeah. And it's not just keeping it going, right? But the reason why it's exciting is because things are changing and things are transforming, right? And transformation brings the energy, right? But transformation is something which doesn't happen all the time. Transformation happens from time to time in your life, right? You go through periods where things are transforming and then periods when things are consolidating. And you can't force that, right? You can't get in the middle of a period of consolidation and force a transformation to happen, right? Then things tend to go cactus. So, but also you can't be attached, and this again is a problem that sometimes people have in the spiritual life. These people get attached to the spiritual transformations which have brought them thus far, right? So the things that you've been going through, you know, and doing the intensive meditation, going to Thailand, is a very transformative period, right? Saying that traveling to another country tends to have a very transformative impact because you're letting go of all of those structures, right, which you've relied on. All the cultural expectations and the language and all of those things get left behind, and then you have to go into a place where you try out new ones. But those new ones aren't kind of inherent in you, right? They're not conditioned in you. They're something you have to adopt and try and play out, right? As well as, of course, doing all the meditation and so on, which is also helping to erase all of these boundaries and stuff in your mind, right? So it tends to be very transformative. It allows all of these things to happen. And you often don't know what the meaning of those things is until much later, right? And so it takes a while for these things to settle down and so on. So you go through that transformative phase, and then later on there's much more quieter phase of consolidation. But then, and this is the important thing, is there also needs to continue, right? So then later on there'll be another period of transformation, right? Another letting go. And you'll have to call into question all of those things which for you now are the great wisdom and the great insight, right? And you have to be saying, maybe that wasn't such a great insight after all, or maybe, you know, maybe I need to take another step, or I need to look in another area or something like that. So and it's when sometimes those transformations can be so powerful and so striking that we can get very attached to them, right? And this is something that you can hear sometimes, and this was pointed out to me once by one of the laywomen from one of the monasteries And she, you know, she said that when she's hearing this particular teacher teach, she's always teaching about things that happened 30 years ago, right? And that's all right to refer to things that happened 30 years ago, but she's saying it's like that's all there is. Hasn't anything happened in the last 30 years, right? And that's actually quite telling. It was when I first kind of noticed that. Oh, actually, that's this, and that's what's happened, right? So that person has gone through that transformation, right? It's like a kind of awakening or something like that that's caused this huge impact in the mind, right? So that from the perspective of now, when you look back, that's still all you can see with this incredible light that outshines everything else, right? So you see that. But nothing's happened in the meantime. It's sort of got stuck, yeah? And so this is the important thing, is we need to keep on being open to that. I'll come to you in a minute. We need to keep on being open to changing again and again and again and again, yeah? When the time's right. Yeah, okay.
Just because maybe when you say the big transformation, I mean, aren't there lots of small transformations that are happening all the time that we're not aware of? And maybe if we were more aware of them, we would get more of that inspiration. Is it true that most of the transformation is actually very gradual?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of cocoon kind of thing, yeah? So the cocoon thing, right? When you're doing the consolidation, it's all sort of happening a little bit inside you, yeah. But yeah, in terms of what's actually manifest, I guess, is what I'm talking about. Yeah, so you got insights, or, you know, it might be a change in your life, how you live, what you're doing, your perspective, what your values in life are, yeah, all of those things, yeah. Ken Wilber uses a kind of a distinction between translation and transformation. Basically, the idea is that most of the time we're translating, right? So what he means by that is that the things that happen to us, we're interpreting in terms of meaning that we already know, right? This is what translation means, right? So something happens, and you have a set of values. And you can judge what happens because you have a relatively well understood set of values that you know about yourself and that can enable you to make sense of that experience. So that's like the translation, right? But the transformation is where you're saying, I don't know what I value anymore, right? What is good and bad? How should I be living my life, right? And that's when the real transformations come. Yeah, I mean, at the end of the transformation, right, you're not going to be completely different to how you were before, right? And obviously you can look back and see, well, yes, of course there's a continuity, right? And there's a growth through that, and you can see, oh yeah, all of those little things that were leading to this, right? But at the time, you know, there's very much that feeling of openness.
Yeah. Way of having transformation, like what I just talked about, or is it just something that happens spontaneously?
Well, I don't think you can force it. You can't make it happen. But I think you can recognize when it is the time. And, you know, I mean, this is what people talk about, like a midlife crisis or something like that, or an existential crisis or something. And that's basically all that is. You know, you get to a point in your life and you realize that the values, the things that I was doing, which meant so much to me, you know, it was important to me to get a career, right? And now I've done that. I'm the boss or whatever. It was important to me to have a family, and now I've kind of done that. I've raised the kids. Now what do I do? Right? And so you get. So I think it's important to recognise when those things happen, and to allow the process to go forward skillfully. Yeah. So I always encourage people to shake, if those things happen, to shake them up, you know? Shake yourself up. Yeah.
I mean, she was like, oh,
well, we have one of our regular supporters at Santi when I was there was Irene De Silva, who's a very kind of sweet lady who she sort of reached retirement age, and she came and she's like, I don't know what to do, I'm not going to be working and so on anymore. And she, you know, she's very kind of gentle, kind kind of person. And I said, okay, you really want to know what you should do? I said, yes. I said, okay, buy a motorbike, get put on a leather jacket, and take up smoking. Right? And she did actually get a leather jacket the next time she came to the monastery, so that was something, right? But this is the point, is that you can't know what you're going to do until you do something different, you know. So you just have to challenge yourself. You know, traveling is a really good way. Maybe just quit your job or whatever. Yeah, you just have to see.
No,
go on. There may be one more question. Go on. One more, go on. Do we have time for one more? Go on, one more, go on.
Just in relation to this, like, I've read some of the Thai Forest books and things like this, and I don't know, sometimes it feels a little crazy and unrealistic in terms of, you know, it's like, oh, I decided to become a monk, and so I lived in the forest and slept 2 hours and meditated 15 hours a day until I, next to tigers, until I got enlightened, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I guess, you know, I'm curious, I mean, maybe you could just, whether it's citing a source, something to explore, or just some of your experience, but people who have really have been successful at this process you're describing and really made progress in a way that I can relate to, that, you know, where I don't have to get a tiger or something like that.
So I was talking to Bhante Buddharakita yesterday, saying, you know, he has so much advantage running a monastery in Uganda. They got, like, you know, proper lions and elephants and stuff like that. We just got kangaroos here. Yeah, I think that's scary. Yeah, I mean, but this is specifically, I think, what the forest tradition really is about. It's about, in a way, revolutionizing Buddhism so that Buddhist practice becomes transformative, right? Because as you've seen, you know, so much in traditional Buddhist cultures, it's not transformative at all, right? It's about reinforcing cultural values, right? It's about reinforcing this is what we believe as a people, this is what we do, and so on. And it's about keeping a society together, and it performs all of those functions. Right, so within that, then you have certain people who will say, hang on, there's something deeper, there's something beyond, and there's something which is really transformative. And, you know, the Buddha used the similes like a chick breaking out of the egg. Yeah? And so, and that's what it's like. And so those things happen, right? But of course, the important thing is you can read those stories all you like, right? And that's the story of what somebody did at a certain place at a certain time. It's not a story of what you should do at this place and this time, right? And I remember when we saw Lumpur Panyavado, the vice abbot of Ajahn Mahabua, he was curiously forward and firm on this topic, actually. Mm-hmm. We went to see him with a group of young monks from Wat Nanachat. And, the, you know, young monks at Wat Nanachat, they tend to be kind of ascetic, and they tend to be a bit gung-ho and a bit macho in how you go about Dhamma practice, right? I'm going to just have 3 mouthfuls of food every day. You know, and then it's like, oh, I'm going to have 2 mouthfuls of food every day, right? I mean, it's not quite that bad, but there tends to be that kind of attitude. And so he was actually, it wasn't something that we'd brought up, it was something that he specifically brought up and talked quite a bit about this. And he said, you know, you hear all of these practices, like people sitting through pain and doing these ascetic practices. He said that these things are only useful if somebody's at a point in their development where that's what they need to do. And if you're not at that point, then it's entirely useless and completely a waste of time for you to be doing these things. Right? And it's only just following the defilements and following conceit and so on. So this is it's really important to recognize with those things that they happen at that time. And even if you look at the biographies of the different monks who practiced in the Thai forest tradition, like say Ajahn Chah or Ajahn Mahabua and other ones, and they also spent many years living in village monasteries. Ajahn Mahabua spent 3 years living in Bangkok studying Pali, and so on and so forth. It wasn't like that was all they did ever, right? They did actually different things at different periods in their lives. So, yeah. Okay. Yes?
I'd like to thank Bhante for pointing out lots to do in the way. The soonest one is on Saturday, there's Buddhism in a Nutshell, which has a variety of speakers, and you have to, that's on Saturday, so it's a bit unusual, and you have to register on the website. And then next...
Who are the speakers, Tim?
It's Peter Kingsford, Teresa Ball, Simon Hilton, and Tina Miller. You know those two.
Okay.
But I'm sure they're all very good.
Of course.
Why else would they be here? And then next Tuesday is the start of 2 talks by Yeshe.
Yeshe.
Yeah. next one.
Okay. Okay, very good. Shall we finish by paying respects to the Triple Gem? Yeah, let's do that. So we should probably do some guided meditation at some point, or some meditation. So let me ask you guys what kind of meditation you want to do. These days I usually teach meditation by democracy. The main reason for that is then you can't blame me if anything goes wrong. Okay, I'm going to give you some options about meditation, which one you want to do. Okay, who wants to do breath? I'll tell you the options first so you can vote, you know what you're going to be voting on. We can do breath meditation, we can do loving kindness meditation, or we can do, I'm trying to think of another one, we can do skeleton meditation. Okay. All right. So who wants to do breath meditation? Zero. Wow. It's amazing. I do this almost quite often now, and you get very different responses every time you do it, right? So nobody wants to do breath meditation. Okay. Loving kindness. Who wants to do loving kindness meditation? Okay. Fairly popular. Skeleton meditation.
What's skeleton?
Well, you'd have to do it and find out. Are you willing?
Sure.
How many got skeletons? I think, do skeletons win? I think skeletons have just edged out the loving kindness. Okay, so we'll do a skeleton meditation. Okay, so we'll do some guided meditation for the next 20 minutes or so. I'll begin by sitting quietly. And letting your mind settle back into your body. Mind starts to think about this and that. Just be aware of it. Accept it. Give it a bit of a hug. Oh, okay. That's what I care about. That's what interests me. Don't try to push the thoughts away or shut them down. Just accept them. But don't indulge them. Be aware. Oh, okay. And just come back and pay attention to the sensations inside your body. So we keep the focus inside our body. We pay attention to the perception of our own skeleton. We start with something that's easy to recognize. Let's start with the top of the skull. Focus your mind on that area. And become aware of what your skull feels like. And we both know that skull. We know that bone through the touch. We can feel the sensation of it inside there. And we also see it using the mind's eye, using our imagination. And we can see the color, the off-white color, the smooth surface, and inside of the bones, very complex honeycomb structure. You can feel the hardness of it, the texture of it. We've all seen many skulls before, we know what they look like. Move your mind down, your center of awareness down, until you can get a sense for the whole skull. You can feel around your eyes, the holes of your eyes and your nose, the cheekbones, the jaw. And this skull, which has been with us our whole life, which has been protecting us, it's so important, and yet we've never paid attention to it. And at the base of the skull, and attached to the spine, and move our attention down, our perception down, in the same way, focusing on each of the vertebrae in our spine, each one having that complex shape, all the vertebrae sitting on top of each other, keeping your body erect, always flexible, moving a little bit. Everything hanging off of that spine. Pay attention to your shoulders, shoulder blades, collarbones, down your arms, and And just getting a clear perception of each of these parts. Same thing with your hands. All of the intricate little bones in your hands and fingers. To your torso and looking at your rib cage, each of the ribs circling around, protecting the heart, your lungs, attached to the spine at the back. And then down to the base of your spine. Your hip bone. Big, heavy bone, very strong. To that is connected the legs, strong bones in your leg, and the lower legs down to your feet, your heels, ankles, all the bones making up the structure of your feet, your toes. returning to the perception of the whole body, feeling your whole skeleton sitting there. Again, keeping that image in the mind that's partly a feeling, partly a knowing what your skeleton feels like inside your body, and also partly a vision, partly an imagination, what your skeleton looks like. Actually, when different people meditate, they will see these things differently. Some people might have more feeling, others may have more seeing. Doesn't matter, as long as your perception is clear and you know what the skeleton is like. So you have that perception of yourself sitting there, just a skeleton. Nothing to get attached to, nothing to be afraid of, nothing to be worried about. Actually, it's kind of fascinating, interesting to consider how your skeleton is, how it works, how all the parts fit together. Now extend your mind using your imagination and think of all the other people sitting in this room. Everybody else, just like you, sitting there with their skeleton inside them. Just a bunch of skeletons sitting meditation together. If there's anyone in the room who you like, anyone who you dislike, anyone who you know, anyone who you've never met before, it doesn't make any difference. It's just bones. Now coming near to the end of the meditation, bring the mind back, come back to your heart, keep the mind inside yourself, inside your own body. just before we finish the meditation, we reflect back over the practice we've done together. What just happened? How did I use my mind? Was that perception of the skeleton clear to me? Was it not? What did it feel like? How did my mind respond? Was there any emotion connected with that experience? How does my mind feel like now, compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize awakening. Sahara.